Welcome to the John Gambling Show with special co-host, Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
It's the Albany legislature here that's at fault, not the unions.
Mayor Michael Bloomberg on the John Gambling Show.
There's some things we have to have taxes for, and that's fine, but you just have to stand up and say some of these things we can't afford.
Now, with New York's only local news talk morning radio program, here are John Gambling and Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
And here we go on our Friday get-together with Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Mr. Mayor, welcome aboard and good morning.
Key number of the day, John?
Key number of the day.
70.
70.
Tomorrow, 70 degrees.
Okay.
Yeah. You said you complained and you said the mayor wasn't doing a good job bringing good weather. And I said, I will work on that. Yeah, and
so
I have.
So
and
what
tomorrow,
happened to Sunday? It's going to be 58.
We take it a day at a time.
Okay. Okay. Fair enough. Good to see you. Yeah. As always, a lot to do here. And you have brought a guest with you this morning.
Yes. You want to introduce Dave?
I do indeed. Dave McCurdy is the president and CEO of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, a former congressman as well from Oklahoma, right? Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, John.
Nice to have you aboard.
We've just been talking. We have lots of friends in common, including the guy that runs the University of Oklahoma, former Senator David Boren is a great guy and a good friend of both of ours.
All right. You have a strong position. We've had some rousing discussions this week on federalism versus statism, which, of course, is part of the discussion right from day one in this country, yeah. Right? How much is good on either side of that particular question? And when it comes to car MPG, you've got a point of view on that.
Absolutely. Working with governors in the state are, one, trying to improve fuel economy for our vehicles. We supported an energy bill a year and a half ago that increased mileage requirements by 40%, which equates to a 30% reduction in CO2.
Using a lot less foreign fuel?
Absolutely, a lot less foreign fuel. And we also support a steady, sustained, ratable increase in fuel economy in the future and believe that working with the new Obama administration have an opportunity to create a single national standard which will have a very stringent requirement but at the same time reduces the complexity of various rules and regulators. And I think having federal leadership, since climate change is a global and national problem, that it takes strong leadership. So we're excited about that. And we also work with consumers. We deal with the technology in producing vehicles, but it's a system, fuels, technology, and ultimately the drivers. And so that's what the mayor and I are going to talk about.
You know, Dave can talk about how you, with whatever car you have, whether it's a gas guzzler or fuel efficient, whatever that means in this day and age, how you drive influences how much gas you use. So you can love your car and want to take the trip, but there's no reason to waste gasoline while you're doing it. And there's some common sense tips that say how you can have that engine need less. And if you take a look, John, I think it's between, Dave, correct me if I'm wrong, but by between 1975 and 85, we improved fuel mileage in this country on average from something like 12 and a half miles per gallon to 25 miles per gallon, double, something like that, but then did nothing from 85 on. And if you go back and think, had we just had a little bit of courage to incrementally, a little bit every year, wouldn't have hurt anybody, today this country would be an awful lot safer because we wouldn't be depending on energy from overseas, and we would have cleaner air, the planet would be better off, but just the air day in and day out that you and I breathe. So just you got to do a little bit, and this does it.
Interestingly enough, just before 8 o'clock, I read a little squib that came off the New York State Thruway about the reduction in driving, both commercial and private, and it's significant, 5.5% in just the first 2 months of 2009.
Because of the economy.
Because of the economy, exactly. Yeah. So I mean, there's benefit to that, but there's obviously problems with that.
Well, one of the problems that we have in the city is, and you're going to read more about this, is the fewer people taking trips. There's also fewer people riding the buses and subways, which means the fares for the buses and subways are running lower than what all of the budget projections had. And all this craziness in Albany about how we're going to pay for the MTA is just that much worse now than it was 2 or 3 months ago.
So unintended consequences.
Well, actually, John, it's significant that the reductions in vehicle miles traveled with the recession and actually increased in safety reduction in fatalities. but you should have seen it during the $4 gas period. During that period, over a six-month period, we reduced vehicle miles traveled in this country by 10 billion miles. So
capitalism works.
Are you two gentlemen suggesting that we should have gasoline at that price all the time? I know some people do.
I have. I mean, it's not popular, but if you want to solve, if you're a capitalist, which I am, and you want to solve the fact that the problem that we are driving gas guzzlers and driving too much and not using mass transit, you have higher fuel prices. Now, people say it'll slow down the economy, and it may, and there are ways to, my suggestion was a tax and take the money and use it to help those who lose their jobs to get training and that sort of thing, so you could transfer the money and not have a bad effect on the economy. But some people think that's terrible, that you shouldn't try to dampen the economy at all. Nevertheless, if you want to stop, to reduce the amount of gasoline, raise the price. And I'd rather have, take the money and pump it into mass transit or pump it into job training. I don't know if Dave agrees or not. Just it's a personal view I've had for a long time.
Actually, I do agree. And I think there's a way you could have a variable floor, and you could call it security charge or whatever. But it's clear that economics and
right. And keep in mind, in New York City, we have a lot of mass transit. A lot of parts of this world, you don't. And even if you go to Staten Island, Staten Island of our five boroughs has a lot less mass transit. People don't have the options. They have no choice but to drive. So they would say that's unfair. People that live where there is good bus and subway service would say it's not. And so it's very different across this country what's right and wrong. But as a country as a whole, if you want to reduce the consumption, you raise the price. You want to increase the consumption, you lower the price. You want to have people buy fuel-efficient cars, raise the price of gasoline. And it's true of all these things.
Well, the irony is that governments want to regulate and require increased fuel economy, transition to new technologies, whether it's hybrids, advanced diesel, fuel cells. But having a cheap energy policy at the same time actually undercuts that, because to do the math for a consumer to make – because these technologies do cost more. Yep. And for us to actually have incentives for consumers to buy that – I think there needs to be a consideration of price. You could offset it with through payroll tax or something for those who are particularly hard hit. But the
it is so
price
complicated
point,
because, yeah. for example, yeah. in the initiative to go to electric vehicles, mm-hmm. That of course means a reduction in the use of gasoline, which removes the tax that goes to maintain the roads and all of the things that the gas tax goes.
The one place where that logic doesn't work is in smoking. People say if everybody stop smoking, you won't get any tax revenues from smoking cigarette taxes. That would be a great thing, because you'd also have less
Correct.
Need to, whereas in gasoline, you can make the case that we need this money to support mass transit and else. The craziest one is all the states got in a settlement money from the cigarette companies.
Tobacco money,
and
right.
they sold bonds based on that, and now the problem is if people stop smoking, they won't be able to pay the interest on the bonds.
We live in a crazy world. Dave, if listeners want more info from your folks, where do they get it?
EcoDrivingUSA.com.
EcoDriving
worked in Europe, actually saw savings of 15%, which translates if New Yorkers just practice this. There are over 2 million registered vehicles in the state, 8 million population. You'd save 1.6 million tons of CO2.
It's some of the governors, for example, that they've signed up. I mean, they're Democrats and Republicans. They're liberals and conservatives. Some are very liberal and some very conservative.
Must be an ugly dinner party.
No. Because everybody's got the same problem. These guys are actually trying to do something. And they're from the West and the East, from the North and the South. And one of the things I should point out, that Dave's organization is giving Plan YC $150,000 to help us get the message out that you can drive. And I noticed there was an article in the Wall Street Journal today in the front section, efficient drivers cut emissions. Now, it does say, but stir up hot air, because it's always controversial. But it's plain and simple. This is you personally when you drive your car. Do you want to waste your money on gasoline, or would you rather spend money on something else that you prefer? Personally, I can think of a lot of things I'd rather buy than another gallon of gasoline.
All part of a very complicated equation that we're trying to work through.
Will you
right
read
now.
This and drive more carefully when you drive home tonight?
I try and drive carefully every day and as efficiently as I can. I don't feel like spending any more.
Well, I don't care whether you do or you don't. Wendy won't let you. Your wife.
Well, exactly.
I know Wendy very well.
Yes,
and she
indeed.
Runs that family.
She sure does. You've been around me too long. Dave, a pleasure to see you. Thank you for coming in this
Thank
morning.
Thank you, John.
All right, Mr. Mayor, hang on. Let me take my first break. We're coming right back here with Mayor Michael Michael Bloomberg at News Talk Radio 710 WOR. All right, we continue here. Mayor Michael Bloomberg and John Gambling at News Talk Radio 710 WOR. Don't forget. I'm sorry, Mr. Mayor.
I was going to say you. I'm no one. You want to talk about what's going from April 17th to April 23rd?
Today is the 17th.
Immigrant Heritage Week.
I didn't know that.
Yes, well, let me tell you this. If you, it's a little bit before your time, but in 1907, on this date in history,
yes, sir,
more immigrants entered through Ellis Island into this country than in any other day in the city's history.
How about that?
We've got a whole bunch of things, 180 different events, and but all kidding aside, the reason I bring it up is we're working hard to make sure that in all languages city services are available, and we're going to put in the mayor's management report which agencies are cooperating and which ones still have work to do, but we're trying to make sure that no matter what language you speak, my mother wants to know why I'm speaking. I'm studying Spanish since she says I haven't mastered English yet. But that's
your mom can say that. No one else is going to say that.
Oh no, some of the report as well.
No one else will say.
But anyways, it's a good thing, and it's just reminds us of how this city is different than others in terms of we welcome immigrants and they make the city.
And Ellis Island is a wonderful place to go if you've never been out there.
It is a wonderful place to go. I've done some events there, and it's you know, great views of the city. You see Ellis Island when I take the ferry over to Staten Island and back. You go by Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty and Governor's Island on the other side, and you look at two golf courses over in New Jersey that the views are of Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty.
They're played over there. Someday I'll have to get over that way. Speaking of playing, you were watching the boys play baseball at both new stadiums.
Both new stadiums. Unfortunately, the games didn't turn out the way we would like them to, but the stadiums are spectacular. And what I thought was the most interesting, and in many senses I was pleased about, you can't compare one to another. They are very different stadiums with very different looks, very different approaches. And I think both really reflect the history of the teams and the kind of fans they attract and that sort of thing. You know, from what I could see, the sight lines are great, the amenities are great, the access is great. You don't get a feeling of it's just so high tech that it has nothing. There's no tradition. I mean, the Yankees, Mike Hopper, who works with me and used to work for the Yankees, was pointing out to me, for example, you get down the third baseline, they've tilted the seats slightly towards home plate. So you have a little bit better view. And because in the past, yeah, I mean, little things that they've done. And the same thing is true with the Wilpons and building the new city field. But the Wilpon family and the Steinbrenner family, you know, if you think about it, when I came into office, the city was going to build two new stadiums. And I said, I'm sorry, we cannot do that. We hadn't signed a deal, although in all fairness, they had been negotiating for a long time with Rudy to do it. But the economy was changing. It was right after 9/11 and the end of the internet bubble. And I said, we can't afford to do this. And both came up with doing it with their own money. It's true. Some critics will say, oh, well, they got these federal bonds that are triple tax exempt, so that they could raise money. Yeah, but they got to pay the money back. And the amount of money the city loses on the interest in those bonds, number one, it's in the couple tens of thousands of dollars in the context of the Yankees spent well over $1 billion. And we wouldn't have had it if they hadn't spent the money, wouldn't have any interest. These were basically done without city money. The city put in some infrastructure money for mass transit access and that sort of thing, which we do with every big project. These aren't any different. And we'll forego a tiny bit of interest, which we wouldn't have had if they didn't build them. And now the city has two great venues, not just for baseball, but you could put concerts in both of these, and I'm sure people will. And, the great additions to the city. And the only regret I have, I was at talking to a group of laborers the other day who built these stadiums. And I said, you know, if we had had the courage to build the stadium, as everybody called it, although I would describe it as really an enhancement to the Javits Center on the west side, today we'd be able to attract a lot of convention business. And today we're really missing that. The people who don't have jobs today, some of them would have had jobs if we had gone ahead. And today the state has no money to go and to really expand the Javits Center, and we're falling farther behind. And
I went past the Javits Center earlier this week, and I'm amazed at how large it is, but I've heard you and others many times say it's minuscule.
John, you could put the Javits Center inside the McCormick Center in Chicago, and they'd still have conventions. I mean, it's when you drive by it in Chicago, you go to and these in other places, you can't compare them. It's just night and day. It's laughable how poor facilities we have. And we, in those days, there was a guy with $1 billion of his own money that was going to build this for us. And all he wanted to do was use it 13 Sundays a year. I hate to keep bringing it up, but I just look back and think of what could have been. And it's a good lesson for us. We can't lose our courage to go and make investments when times are tough or when there's a handful of naysayers. We've got to go build for the future. And we've done it in the case of the new Citi Field and the new Yankee Stadium. And I think both owners are to be congratulated. And personally, I just want to say thank you. I'm glad they had the confidence in this city and the courage to go do it and take the criticism. And I hope they have great, both have, they better have winning seasons or I'm going to stop. I mean, I sat next to
too much money's been invested,
I sat next
right?
to Rudy for a little while yesterday at Yankee Stadium. And he didn't say it, but I know in the back of his mind, he was saying, hey, I delivered a Subway Series or a World Championship. You know, what about you?
Yeah, what are you going to do, Bloomberg? Okay. Mr. Mayor, hang on. Let me take a break here. It's 8:30. Don't forget your questions before we finish up the show at 800-321-0710. You better get in line now. They fill up quickly. 800-321-0710 for your questions. We're coming right back. All right, we're back with Mayor Michael Bloomberg, 23 before 9 o'clock. Traffic update, or this portion of the program brought to you by CNN this Saturday night. CNN. And Dr. Sanjay Gupta follows four addicts on a journey through recovery and relapse. It's called Addiction. Saturday night, 8 o'clock on CNN. Mr. Mayor, we have another iteration on helping the MTA plan.
Either that or we don't.
Well, see, that's it. And we seem to seemingly go nowhere here.
Well, look, I think in all fairness, the heroes here are Dick Ravitz, who's trying very hard to do something to fix the problem. In all fairness, the governor, who's trying to do it. Shelley Silver, who, you know, is not coming up with a plan that I wanted, but a plan that will work, deserves some credit. You know, it's hard to, you can't complain about people that have real ideas. The trouble is over in the Senate, they're not real ideas. Everybody throws something out and sees.
Yeah, you need a doctor's note to get across bridge.
You know, once you start, if you start changing tolls for different people at different times,
you can't win.
It's all over. You just, there's every little group will get there this year, next year, the year after. We've seen that before. You either everybody pays or nobody pays. I think that's, in a practical point of view, the only thing that makes any sense. What is happening is as we dither, the situation gets worse. Every day, the infrastructure gets a day older and is going to need more money to fix it and make it better and expand it. And we have no money. And none of these proposals really have a lot of money for capital projects. The economics of the MTA, as the economy slows down, fewer people are taking buses and subways, so their revenue is down. Their support from other taxes like property, real estate transfer taxes has declined dramatically. Nobody, you know, no matter, nothing they can do about it, but that's one of their revenue sources. Their labor costs, they are going into binding arbitration. And when Ravitz puts out numbers, it only includes a 1.5% increase in labor. And labor hopes that they'll get a 4% increase, some number like that, from an arbitrator. I don't know if they will or not, but that would just totally blow the budget. So even if the legislature does nothing, and the board of the MTA, which I have 4 votes on out of 16, we will vote to increase fares because you can't close it down, and labor is going to get paid or they're not going to show up to work. They've got families to feed, in all fairness. Even if you do this, by the end of this year, we'll be right back with another disaster and have to raise fares again. And I don't know what happens after that. Nobody can see that far into the future. But we need a solution to the problem, and it's got to be a combination of other revenue sources and some toll increases or card fare increases and some efficiencies in the management of the MTA and pulling things together. They have, for example, more than one bus company. When you see on the side of a bus, SCAPFA is one of them, and New York City Bus is another. You think it says New York City Bus. You're saying, oh, that's good. This is a bus from New York City. Well, thank you. I don't know why they had to tell me that. No, that's the name of the company. And each one of those bus companies has a whole bunch of infrastructure stuff that if it was in our education system, for example, people would be demanding that we get rid of and move them money into the classroom where it belongs. Well, here, we should be demanding they get rid of that. The trouble is there's different bureaucracies and appointees and unions, and everybody's got to – it takes some courage to pull it all together. And the Senate's got to find a ways to do this. And they keep talking about bipartisan support. But, you know, remember when the last time you didn't have bipartisan support when the Republicans ran the Senate, and you don't have bipartisan support when the Democrats run the Senate. Traditionally, these organizations never bring anything to a vote unless they're sure it's going to pass, and pass without votes from the other party.
In fact, Malcolm Smith has said that point that you just made about not bringing to a vote unless we can pass it on the gay marriage bill that the governor...
Look, that's not democracy. If you're going to have democracy, you put things up to a vote, let them discuss things. You know, I've said 1,000 times, New York City is very well served by its city council. Our city council passed rules, which maybe takes away some of their power, makes them more accountable. It's good democracy. And in New York City, every bill is read by every single councilman. At least they have the time to days to do it. They have public hearings on every bill. And then when they pass a bill, it comes to me, and I hold a public hearing on it. And, you know, Albany should do the same thing. They should force their members to stand up and say... what they stand for, and have a public discussion and try to convince each other of the merits of their position. And, you know, I've been speaking to people on all sides, with Democrats and Republicans, the Senate, the Assembly, and the governor, to see if I can help. But this is – the city did its part. The city came up with a plan. The city council passed.
Are you frustrated?
I'm always optimistic. I mean, yeah, sure, everybody's frustrated. Why can't we come? But the frustration, keep in mind, is part of a democracy. So that's not the big thing here. The big thing is we're playing with the future of our city. We have to have mass transit that people can afford to use and that serves the whole community, all the catchment area as well as in the city, that's safe and pleasurable and a better alternative than driving, or we're not going to have a future. And this brinksmanship, and everybody's got something they don't like. You're never going to pass anything if you don't say, okay, it's not everything I want, but on balance, it's just what's right for the city, for the area, for the state. And sometimes that requires doing something that's politically maybe not popular in your home district. But that's what leadership is all about. And, you know, I'm not here to criticize anybody. I'm here to try to help. But they've got to do it.
On another major point that we continue to talk about seemingly on a weekly basis, but one that is, I think, absolutely critical, again, to the future of the city of New York, and that is mayoral control of the schools. There are those in the Senate and those in the Assembly that want to yank it away from the mayor, not just Michael Bloomberg, but from the mayor. Is this... political, or is there something else involved?
I don't want to characterize it anyways other than to state the facts. Before mayoral control, we had in the school districts where we had the biggest problems and pedagogical problems, because the people in those districts came from families that were starting up the economic ladder, and a lot of them were communities that people had come here from overseas and didn't speak English or didn't have a background, a continuous education, that sort of thing. We underfunded the schools for minorities, and the minorities were getting a much worse education than others, and the graduation rates were abysmally low, and crime was rampant in the schools. Since taking over, and we couldn't attract teachers, since taking over the school systems, crime down 35%, graduation rates up 25%, double-digit raises in math and English scores, biggest construction budget for schools ever. We have 50,000 or 60,000 teachers from around the country that want to come and teach here. There's an optimism.
So what's the motivation? We have more charters. Of the opposition.
It is not trying to improve the school system, that's for sure. And all of the proposals I've seen to change it take you right back to that same thing where It was not it was designed for the people that work in the system or for others with special interests and not for the kids. It is inconceivable that if you look at the numbers, you can vote anyplace else. And my hope is we can convince the legislature of that and that the leadership is going to have to stand up. And the other thing is you'd have chaos if you don't renew this law, which expires the end of June, because I don't know how you'd put the genie back in the bottle. I don't know how you'd recreate the bureaucracy. And all of the monies that we've taken out of the bureaucracy and put in the classroom would go right away out of the classroom and go back into the bureaucracy. There's no
back in Livingston Street.
Right, but well, that building, fortunately, we sold, but you'd have to do it. It would be a disaster in the classroom for, I don't know how you'd open the schools next September.
Kindergarten, shortfall this coming September.
Shortfall is, you can look at it, too many kids want to go to public schools. The schools are better, and ACS doesn't have the money to have some of the programs that they did have pre-kindergarten and
what happens to these kids?
We're going to have to find some way. It's going to be tough because we don't have the money, but we're not going to let the kids go without getting an education, and we'll figure out a ways to do it. It may mean larger groups of kids, but the reality is we can't have everything. People say, I want very small class size. I want one teacher per kid. That's the ultimate ways of the ultimate small class size. Well, we do have that, John. Special ed kids, an awful lot of them do get one teacher per kid. But we can't have that. We can't afford it. It'd be nice, but we can't afford it. I'd like to pay our teachers even more. At least we've raised their salaries 43% in the last 7 years. They now get paid as well as they get paid in the suburbs. And that's never been done before. But there's a limit to how much you can pay for every one of the services. Everybody says, look, I'd like to pay the cops more, the firefighters more, the teachers this, that. Yes, so would I. But we've been very generous in the context of the public doesn't have the money to pay more taxes or certainly doesn't want to. And it's balancing. And somebody said to me yesterday, we're going to have to cut back this program and that program. I said, yes, that's what government's all about, making decisions. And the old standard of, well, we'll give everybody everything or some of everything, doesn't work when the economy is slowing down. Our tax revenues for this coming fiscal year will be $5 billion less than they were in 2008. Now, we've cut $3 billion out of the budget, and we've got some things we need Albany to help us do to help balance the budget, and we will, with the city council, pass a balanced budget, which the law requires, before the end of June. But these are tough times, and everybody would love to say, yes, I will give you this, give you that. That's not the real world.
I want to ask your point of view. We all know about your crusade, and you were this week down in Virginia against illegal guns. Obviously, a smart way to go here. What is your take on the reported increase of gun and ammo sales across the country?
I don't know. I mean, people attribute this to things. There's a feeling among a handful of gun advocates that, they're going to take away my guns. I don't know anybody that is any rational person or thinking person that's proposing we change the Constitution. Mm-hmm. The Second Amendment is clear. You have the right to bear arms. Having said that, I don't think the Founding Fathers envisioned guns in the hands of criminals, which is against federal law, a federal law that is constitutional. And it's the First Amendment gives you the right to say anything, but you don't have a right to scream fire as a joke in a crowded theater. It's the Second Amendment gives you the right to bear arms. It doesn't give a criminal the right to carry a concealed weapon on the streets of big cities in this country. Plain and simple, there are some limitations, practical ones. And
a concern, or is this just something that I think
just comes and goes, and let's get on with it. I was with the families, or some of the families of Virginia Tech victims down in Virginia. I've said this before, but those who are against any kind of gun controls, they should have come. Mrs. Timoshenko, whose son was a police officer, killed, and she was down there with us. You go and give a eulogy at her son's funeral, and then tell me that you think that we shouldn't do something about guns in the hands of criminals.
All right, Mr. Mayor, we got a full bank of phones here. We will get to those in just a moment. So let me take our final break right here. We will be coming back 10 before 9 o'clock. You're next. It's 5 before 9 o'clock. It's time for you here at News Talk Radio 710 WOR. You've got the questions for Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Pick up your headset there, Mr. Mayor, and we'll see what Robert Manhattan has to say. Robert, you got the mayor. Go.
Good morning, Mayor Bloomberg. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sir, you're an inspiring figure. Now, I just wanted to say a couple of things. Now, My grandfather came from Poland right around 1907, the year that you cited before. My wife is an immigrant. I have a small business. Everybody that works for me are immigrants, and they all learn to speak English. And my father used to say, when your grandfather came from Poland, they didn't have signs and documents in Polish. He learned English. So I beg to differ with you, sir.
All right. Well, Robert, let's flip the mirror.
Robert, number one, things are different. When your grandparents' parents and my grandparents came here, there was a feeling they wanted to get rid of any recollection of where they came from in their minds, their language, their customs. They wanted to be Americans, and they felt that they couldn't carry it. Today, I think it's fair to say immigrants, you know, they hyphenate where they come from. They're, you know, I'm an Italian-American, I'm an Irish-American, a Jewish-American, whatever. And so they are proud of, the way I phrase it, they're proud of where they came from and proud of where they are. And I think they want to be Americans just as much as our grandparents did. The difference, what we're trying to do is to provide the services while they're learning English. I couldn't agree with you more. I think for citizenship, you should speak English. And it's also true, Robert, that America is the death of foreign languages. You know, you're no matter how quickly the immigrant learns, their children invariably speak English. And I can just look at my Spanish. I mean, the next generation, my Spanish isn't better than theirs, but I can find errors in what they do, and I'm the worst student in the world. So I hear you, but I think we have to provide these services because those who are here need to be able to understand what's going on. Long term, I do agree with you, they should learn to speak English, and they will. They're just the natural thing. You don't have to legislate it. It's just it invariably happens. But, you know, and thanks for having a business and employing people from around the world. Hopefully it helps your business.
It was a good question, too. Thank you very much. Let's go to number three here, Morty in Brooklyn. You've got the mayor. Right to the question, please, Morty.
Yes, gentlemen, good morning. With the prospect of 7,000 layoffs, have you given any thought to an early incentive retirement buyout, which not only would help you this year, but with revenues down for the following year, would certainly help you for the following year and for many years to come?
I think one of the problems is Morty, when we've looked at incentives, you give the incentives to those with the most seniority who are likely to retire anyway. So the city pays but doesn't, you know, it gets something that would have happened. Also, if you're a senior person, you're getting paid more, the incentives have to be so much bigger. And one of the problems we've had is that we've tried to downsize by attrition, but people aren't quitting. And that's the same thing that the private sector has when they try to downsize by attrition. In this day and age, when there aren't a lot of other jobs and people are worried about their 401ks or their pension funds.
In the good times, people will do that.
In the good times, people do that. In the bad times, they don't. So, you know, we've looked at it. It just doesn't seem to make any sense. It might make sense in some organizations in the private sector, but in the public sector, you really can't do it in any meaningful ways. It would cost a lot, and it wouldn't achieve anything other than the time wouldn't do it on its own.
All right, Morty, thanks a bunch. Let's go to Richard. Richard, you're with the mayor. Go.
Mr. Mayor.
Hi.
Hey, I'm a longtime resident of Rockaway, and I was just wondering, there's a abandoned property, or I should say undeveloped property, between Beach 36th Street and Beach 56th Street, right up against the boardwalk.
Yep.
And I know they're trying to bring tourist revenue to Rockaway, and I was just wondering why they don't have a vineyard in Rockaway like they do in Long Island.
Interesting.
I don't know whether grapes would do well that close to the ocean. Because I think if you
go
out
around the world,
Eastern Long Island, both the North and South Fork, where there are plenty of vineyards, they're not right on the beach, but that may be because beach property just isn't available to turn the vineyards. It's an interesting idea. Hopefully somebody that wants to, my personal interest in wine is to be a drinker, not a producer.
But you could become the little old winemaker,
that's not my, I've been to vineyards that one grape looks like another grape. I just want to know what the stuff tastes like. If anybody's listening and wants to open a vineyard in the Rockaways, Richard points out there's land available.
My guess is it would have to do with taxes, and it's all an equation, probably.
And whether or not the salt air is good for you.
Exactly. So, Mr. Mayor, that's going to do it for right now. Not enough time, not enough seconds here to get another telephone call in, unfortunately, but we'll see if we can get together next Friday.
Looking forward to it. Weather's going to be great tomorrow. Iffy on Sunday.
When do they start closing the streets, summertime?
Yeah, a long time before.
All right. Have a good one, Mr. Mayor. Thank you very much. And that's going to do it for everybody here on the John Gambling Show, at least for this week. We'll re-energize for you on Monday starting at 5:30. I hope you will be along. Have yourselves a wonderful weekend. It is 9 o'clock.